We made this.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. For this week's Noirvember installment, I'm bringing you another of my friend Tony Black's recordings from his abandoned podcast for New Wave. You may remember similar episodes from earlier this year on Bonnie and Clyde, Reflections in a Golden Eye, and In the Heat of the Night. For this one, Tony teamed up with writer and podcaster Leslie Byron Pitt to discuss Robert Altman's 1973 film The Long Goodbye. Now, obviously, the 1970s is a bit outside the time frame we usually discuss on the Movie Palace, but I thought it'd be nice to air this episode for Noirvember, not least because the guys talk a bit about the classic noir era and the distinctive way Altman adapted Raymond Chandler's 1953 novel. So let's hear what they both had to say.
So yeah, we're going to be talking about The Long Goodbye, which is the one of Raymond Chandler's books featuring his PI character, Philip Marlowe, and he is investigating the mysterious death / suicide of a friend of his, set in early 1970s Los Angeles, and it leads him down a rabbit hole of sex, seduction and murder in amongst the elite and rich of the City of Angels. I was putting out there ideas for films that people might want to do, and you know, you were keen, Les, on The Long Goodbye as a seasoned film fan and somebody who's got a really good appreciation of especially classic film. What was it about Robert Altman's movie that drew you in?
Well, for me, what I love, if we start from the beginning, what I love about Altman is they still do call him the Maverick. There is no one in American cinema that kind of films and shot like he does. And I'm a massive Paul Thomas Anderson fan. So obviously watching Paul Thomas Anderson and realizing he kind of came from Altman, and looking at Altman's films, you realize that Anderson is his own thing, but you can see him riffing on an Altman, and it's so, he's just got this idiosyncratic style that I find just unbelievably unique. I find him a bit of a environmental filmmaker in his style and how he puts things together. So what drew me towards Altman, and particularly this film, which is possibly my favourite next to Free Women, is how he sets up scenes, how he shoots scenes, how he understands that he has a widescreen and utilises the aspect ratio in order to make sure that everything's involved. And when I say he's an environmental filmmaker, he's not trying to save the planet. It's more the sense of he looks at the old films, he's clearly looked at the kind of old films of the 50s and realised, like, well, we're not working in 4x3 here, we can kind of branch out and I can do it in my style. And then he realises that he can film a little bit more on location, and not only can film on location, he can film and have, and he can establish this new surrounding, even though it is set in LA, for this Philip Marlowe character. And it's no surprise to me that many people turned around when it first came out and were like, what are you doing? This is awful. This is really, really bad. Pauline Kael is a massive Altman fan, and she said, yep, this is great. And Ebert was okay with it as well. However, there was, you know, lots of kind of, what have you done? You've kind of ruined this for the source. But what I love about this, what I love about that, Altman, is he was always this revisionist. If you look at McCabe and Mrs. Miller, if you look at something like California Split, or even Gosford Park. I think it's best, like, Gosford Park is a murder mystery where the murder doesn't matter because it's all about the class struggle and it's all about the upstairs, downstairs, and Ryan Phillippe's sleeping around and Stephen Fry coming in there to kind of investigate but not, and disappearing. And that's, you know, that's what he does. That's always been Altman's thing. And I think it's just a little bit more ahead of its time. I think you could easily have done this movie similar to just following the source and tracking the source and doing it as a hard-boiled noir story as per usual. But I don't think you get that kind of interesting critique on 70s LA and 70s America that I think Altman infuses in here. And I just like the fact that what he does is he updates Marlowe to be this character who's kind of lost in here. Like, if you go to the Blu-ray and listen to some of the interviews, he says, well, he starts off in bed, it's almost as if he got cast through time and just woke up at this moment in time. And I love that. And I love the idea that there's this moralistic man who is now stuck in a 70s America, which doesn't know what to do with him. And that's what drew me into it. It's such a perfect 70s film. It's exactly what the new wave was kind of saying. It was going, we are in a completely different place now. We've got stuff like Vietnam, and we've got all the cynicism and obviously Nixon and all these political aspects kind of swirling around. I can't remember when Nixon took office, so forgive me if I'm wrong, if I'm ahead of time or below, and same with Vietnam. But it was around this time where there was an inset of paranoia and weirdness and strangeness, and LA was getting into this is 1973, so this was after the Summer of Love, so the hippie movement had kind of just died on its ass. And not only did it die on its ass, America had changed and goes, this didn't work. And you had cultism, and it wasn't just a new way for cinema, it was a new way for everything. There's a reason why there's all these naked women kind of just next door to Philip Marlowe. And you look at The Big Sleep, and you look at Murder, My Sweet, and you look at these other movies. And what's really cool about Marlowe in that is, like, he just seems to be this kind of cool, casual ladies man. But now you threw him in the 70s, and he's just off everything. And I find that so interesting. And I like that kind of jarring dichotomy. And that's what Altman for me was always about.
I agree with a lot of that. I'm not as admittedly as schooled in Altman as you are yet. But from what I have seen, I think the naturalism that, you know, he's known for, it really infuses The Long Goodbye with it's got a very hazy sort of dreamlike quality to it a lot of the time. You know, it feels like it's just carrying you along on a wave. You know, it almost feels sometimes a little bit aimless. I mean, one of the things that really struck me was, even though it does have a plot, even one of the things that struck me was that, you know, it spends the first, like, 5 minutes with Marlowe just wandering around his apartment feeding his cat, you know, and that, to have that freedom to just open on a character just looking around for cat food to feed his cat, and having that sense that, like you said, that he's just woken up after a 20-year sleep, after a big sleep, shall we say, is really interesting, and it's unexpected. And I think that the way then it carries you off through the film, there's something really sort of beguiling about the whole thing. You know, it doesn't, I mean, it's, we'll get into this, but it's so different from the novel. I mean, in many ways it's got essentially the same story, but with a few significant tweaks along the way and changes, but it's essentially the same plot line. But the Marlowe character is vastly different, and as you said, it reflects a different age. It reflects this, you know, the age of the new Hollywood. And you know, you talk about Nixon. Nixon resigned a year after this, and this was all at the point where Vietnam had come to an end in 73. you've got Watergate on the horizon, you know, the Watergate breaking, which leads to his downfall. So this is, you're right, this is sort of on the cusp. You're absolutely right in what you said. It's on the cusp of this big American change and this new sense of anxiety that a lot of these filmmakers, you know, to some extent were sort of, they were coming off the back of the sexual revolution into this sense of things aren't going well. You know, things aren't really, things are starting to change, and they're not necessarily changing for the better. And then that's what 70 cinema is all about. That's why, I mean, it's awfully negative, but, you know, I've said before on this podcast, I love 70 cinema the most because it's fascinating in what it's saying. And something like The Long Goodbye, even though it's based on a 50s novel, it doesn't, that's almost incidental. You know, I mean, Chandler was long dead by this point, but it might as well not be adapted from his book at all, because it's such a piece of its time, and yet forward. Like you said, I completely agree with when you said it's forward thinking. It doesn't feel like a film that people have done a lot before, you know, in terms of its stylistics. So it's really interesting in the way Altman takes this text and runs with it.
Yes, I mean, it's hard because I know there's a lot of sticklers for source material, and I get that, but I a part of me always gets a feeling, well, how boring would films be if we were just so slavish to literary canon? And this is from someone who is interested in adaptation in a certain way, and I don't read enough, but I find it really interesting when films do deviate from the book for whatever reason, and a lot of sometimes it's just for time, but other reasons it's just, well, can we do this, will it translate very well, do we want to do this? And I find it really difficult. Well, why would we look at stuff like The Big Sleep or like early Marlowe and early noir for something that's in the 70s? I wasn't sure why we would look at things that way. And I don't know. I mean, what I love about this for me is there is just the way he establishes this LA setting. And one thing I love about Altman is he doesn't, you know, there's no real standardized kind of setup shot of stuff, and then stuff happens, and, you know, shot reverse shots don't really happen as much, and a lot of it is just these slow zooms in, and there's something going on. He really utilizes as much of the screen as possible. Something's going on in the background is just as important as going on in the foreground. Like you say, the cinematography from, I can never say pronounce this gentleman's name, Zygmunt...
Zygmunt, maybe?
Yes. The cinematography from this is brilliant, and you've got these highlights that kind of bleed into anything and giving this dreamlike feeling that you said. But then also you've got John Williams doing the score, and the score is the same song just rearranged and replaced, and it's almost as if this is almost like a feedback loop all the way through, and it's just saying the long goodbye, long goodbye. It's kind of telling Marlowe what's going on, and there's just these beautiful moments in this film that I don't think you could really get, that I don't think would have as much effect on me if we went down this kind of very dead normal noir route. There's a beautiful shot in this movie on where Sterling Hayden's character Wade is talking to his wife Eileen, and while they're talking, the waves are crashing behind. They're inside. Marlowe is walking by the sea into the sea, and it's such a weird, almost like a transition, almost like a fade. And it's done in such a way that it almost looks like a foreshadowing of a certain character and what will happen to them later. And I'm thinking, this is absolutely sublime. And that's what I mean by the idea of Altman being this kind of environmental director. He kind of sets things up in such a really fascinating way. And he makes sure that you get a feel of this LA. He makes sure you get a feel of of these characters and the world they inhabit. And also as well, this is from what I remember from reading. I was halfway through the book. I still need to finish it. But from it's interesting to read the book, and the book is very sort of short, sharp, just hits you with just the way it's punctuated. Whereas this kind of lazy, dreamlike thing just is really interesting, considering that everyone that Marlowe meets just is so unscrupulous and just so uncaring. Like you say, he goes to feed his cat in the first 10 minutes, but when he speaks to that store clerk, the store clerk is like, I've got a girl, what are you talking about with this cat food? Yeah. And it's such a really, it's a really abrasive thing, and it sets everything up. The only people that are really that seem to be okay with Marlowe are his neighbor girls, and even they want something for almost nothing, and by the end of it they're not even listening to him, they're just, you know,
spaced out.
And it's this really interesting film which comes a year before Taxi Driver, which also I think it details a lonely man here as well as, you know, Schrader and Scorsese, but he details this lonely man who has a set of morals and a set of decency, and it's the world that is just trying to envelop him. And it's what I love about it is it turns into this really evocative tragedy. It's really, there's something particularly sad about how everything plays out, especially when you know what happens in the book, and you know, but you see what happens in the film. And I think that was really interesting. And I think what you say about directors kind of picking up on anxieties, I think that was true. I think maybe it might have been unconscious, but I think they really kind of harped onto something here, because soon afterwards and slightly before, you started to get the paranoid thrillers as well, and of how tragic everything is, and how the hippie culture was just really a kind of to many people a sort of self-obsession, and how people were lost in it and didn't understand that. And I find that really interesting.
I think it's all about a sense of general moral decline, you know, in many ways, this film. Like you said, Marlowe's sort of he's the guy pushing against the tide. The world is changing around him. The world has changed. You know, that's the thing about a lot of the films in this era are all about characters who are either enveloped by change, or they are having to change, or they can't deal with change. And somebody like Marlowe is looking around at everybody else, all these entitled, privileged, wealthy, you know, bastards basically, who are just killing each other and sleeping with each other and treating each other like shit. And he is looking around at all of them, and he's depressed by it, if anything. You know, he feels all these people are just, you know, and the one of the core things that I think the film retains from the book is his determination to believe in somebody. You know, he wants to believe in Terry Lennox, you know, all the way through. Terry Lennox being the friend of his who then commits suicide in Tijuana when he asks Marlowe to take him there, and then he's accused of murdering his wife, which is what gets Marlowe into, you know, the investigation, which leads him down a rabbit hole into this you know, valley of rich people and the characters of Roger and Eileen Wade, who are you know, involved in all this. And it takes him down this rabbit hole, you know, and he's got the cops on his back, he's got, you know, other wealthy people around him who are on his back, and, you know, several key characters from the book are excised, like Lennox's wife's dad, who's this billionaire in the book, and he exerts some influence. But, you know, there's some of the key ideas are still there, and the central one being, as I say, he wants to believe that Lennox didn't kill his wife, and he wants, the whole point of this, getting involved with these people, is to prove that. And, you know, I'm going to assume that anyone who is listening to this has watched the film. So, you know, ultimately, do you want me to ruin the book ending for you, Les? Are you too fussed?
From what I remember, I kind of read a kind of a short summary, so I don't mind too much because I've also seen the film.
Okay, well, in the book and the film, Lennox turns out to be alive, and in the book, he comes back and finds Marlowe. With a Latin sort of alias and costume, and Marlowe figures out it's Lennox. And ultimately, Lennox isn't the one who kills his wife. Lennox in the book he's as much a victim in some ways as everybody else. He gets sucked into this world, and the, you know, the long goodbye almost is you know, it's many things, but in the book, it, for me, it was almost that Marlowe didn't really want to say goodbye to somebody who he knows he's never going to see again. But ultimately, it's there's a level of vindication in that he's been tainted by all this, but ultimately the people who did the terrible deeds are in some way punished or some way face a level of justice, whether it's suicide or whether it's, you know, well, usually it's suicide. They take their own lives because they're cowards. But in the film, that's not what happens. In the film, Lennox is as bad as everybody else. And I think one of the big things that I think struck a chord with people at the time, and it really shocked me, was the decision that Marlowe kills Lennox at the end, takes out a gun and shoots him. And that's apparently something that Altman insisted on. He said, I will not accept a different ending. When they came up with this, he said, this is the ending I want to do. And otherwise, I'm not doing the film, essentially.
Well, that's the maverick side of him, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. He stuck to his guns in taking this character who, you know, we have to remember, Marlowe was already a famous character in literary sense and, you know, a cinematic sense. Humphrey Bogart played him in The Big Sleep, you know, which is one of the classic 1940s noir films, you know, with Lauren Bacall and, you know, just legendary film. Even by this point, The Big Sleep was a legendary film. So to take a character like Marlowe and have him, for me, almost, in a way, he almost becomes as bad, not as bad, but he almost sinks to the same level of he has to commit a murderous act in order to exact some level of justice. And he doesn't have to do that in the book. And if anything, that's more reflective of an era where the anxiety and the fear is we are going to have to become as bad as everybody else if we either want to survive or we want to make some justice.
But that's what I kind of love about it. I mean,
yeah, me too. I really liked it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing for me is, I mean, we're reviewing this now and we're looking at this now at a time where, and I know you're a bigger fan than myself, but we're looking at this at a time where we're talking about James Bond, and we're talking about James Bond and who he's going to be next and the franchise and what do we do and everything. And one of the things I found in going back into this and digging into the movies and kind of going back over the book slightly is Marlowe's character has a lot more room for me in terms of adaptation. And that's what I like about the idea of Altman turning around and going, this is what I want to do, and turning around doing it. And it's one of the reasons why I think it's amazing that he turns it into this great tragedy, that this one lone man who's got this one moral, this moral code that he wants to keep, has to break it at the end. And what I also love is he as much as he alters aspects of the Marlowe character, he doesn't change it as much as I think people think. I think you look at Murder, My Sweet and you look at The Big Sleep, and the big thing about the Marlowe character now, what is there is an itch that he can't scratch. And that's why he has to go through and he has to see everything through. And the plots are very similar in the sense of one thing starts the plot and then it goes on, it's actually something else and there's deeper and this, that and the other. But while I agree with you that the plot here is kind of dreamlike and kind of takes a back end to everything, it's still easy to follow. It's still complicated, but it's still got a narrative drive. You can still follow everything through, as opposed to The Big Sleep. Now, The Big Sleep is a good film. It's a good film. There's some really great moments in it, but it is driven by the fact that the character just has hunches that are always right, and it is driven by the fact that I remember watching it going, this is actually quite confusing. What's going on? And it's interesting that we keep, like, so many people, you know, especially with the fact that we've got film canon now, will be like, well, it's a great movie, it's a fantastic movie. And I'm like, oh, it's actually quite confusing. I think Bogart is a very charismatic Marlowe, but I think he's better than Dick, I can't remember his name, sorry, Dick Powell. For Murder, My Sweet, but I think that there's something about Elliot Gould that is so interesting. I mean, Elliot Gould in the 70s was just charisma all over. And I think that's what I liked about it. It's just, it reminds me of what you can do. And I think going back to like my first point is with this Marlowe character, you can turn around and make him this kind of charming guy, but he doesn't always kind of get the girl, and it's not just so easy for him to do this, and he doesn't fight his way through everything because the other ones didn't, but he hardly ever fights in this. He's always taking blows. Whereas those earlier films, and I'm guessing like some of the books, I just get the feeling he was just this tough nut to crack, and that's about it. And when I say that's about it, you know, don't kill me on this, like Charlie. I don't mean it in a dismissive way. I mean, it's just, I just think there is a little bit, there's more nuance in what you could do with the character in terms of adaptation. There's more nuance for me in this Marlowe than you see in others, and it's a type of thing, and why we have problems with something like James Bond, because there's a rigidness in that character that once you try and deviate from it, no longer becomes that character. Whereas here, I get the feeling that it was, you can, if you know what I mean, you can yeah. play it. There is a malleable aspect to it. I may be wrong, but you know.
No, you may have a good point there. It's funny, after I watched this, much as I really liked it, part of me then wanted to see a genuine sort of adaptation of the book, you know, as it was written, and maybe set in the 50s, just to see the difference, you know, and to see what it would be like if you actually... I don't think anyone's actually done this as a big screen movie. I'm sure it's been done in audiobook and maybe even, you know... on TV, The Long Goodbye, you know, as a pure adaptation, but I'd have to look that up. But, you know, in terms of big screen movie, I don't think it's been done. And I think it would be interesting to see the difference because, you know, you James Bond is an interesting comparison because, if anything, now, with the newest incarnation, it's gone back to the source material in many ways. And it's just taken the essence of Ian Fleming and it's put it into a modern-day context. Now, if you were to make The Long Goodbye, you know, some people would probably be tempted to update Marlowe to now, you know, to the present day, and have some sort of, you know, shaggy dog, you know, LA detective in the modern context. Or even if you did it as a 50s, you know, period piece now, I still think you would have a very, no one would ever make it in the way that Altman did this film with Marlowe.
The closest you get is Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice.
Probably, absolutely.
It's a different author. It's Tom and Pynchon, yes. A completely different book, and that's one of those really weird, convoluted films that goes around to nowhere, but it kind of comes back again. But again, I think that's really environmental. It's trying to kind of show you that sun-kissed California in the same way this does, and in the same way Chinatown does. The second closest would probably be, and now it's 20 years young, I'd probably say The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, absolutely. Films like that would you know, that those kind of approaches are in that same, in a similar vein. You know, I mean, if Paul Thomas Anderson for Inherent Vice wasn't in some way taking a cue from The Long Goodbye, I'd be very surprised, you know, because in some way, because he's a big Altman fan for a start.
So he was the guy on Altman's last film, a Prairie Companion. I can't remember what his film called. He was on the insurance that if anything was to happen to Altman, it would be finished by.
Right, exactly.
By Anderson. And looking at Inherent Vice, it seems to be one of the closer Altman-esque, Altman-inflected movies that he's made, that and Magnolia, considering Shortcuts. And it's one of those things where I did this on another podcast, because I did Long Goodbye on another podcast, along with Inherent Vice, and the it was all about gumshoes and stuff. And the guy I talked to about it, he was like, I don't understand this. It doesn't make any sense. It didn't go anywhere. And I can understand that. But it was more of a mood piece. And I think, well, for me anyway, it was more of a mood piece. And I think that's ultimately, if we were going to see any kind of modern take on the likes of Chandler these days, I reckon they would probably be more mood pieces over anything else, mostly because we can do more with the camera, we can do more things, but also because I think people just get a little bit pretentious with it. I don't think they would want to see a straight out hard boiled movie, and I think they wouldn't want to show that to audiences. I think they want to try and inflect it with something. I don't know, because it doesn't exist. But
you're probably right. It's interesting that even at the time this was made, you know, the script, the adaptation was by Lee Brackett, who did The Big Sleep as well. And it was interesting that she made the point that it was the actual novel, in terms of the novel, was already, The Private Eye, even at that time, was already a cliche, you know. And they had to take what is a big book, you know, it's 450 pages, and it is very convoluted. You know, she made that point. She said, if you did it the way you wrote it, you would have a 5-hour film. You know, if you did it in terms of the actual plot mechanics, because it is quite convoluted, and there are lots of red herrings and twists and turns, and there are characters who in the book have more to do or are completely excised, you know, and in some ways, some of what the film does I like more. You know, I like, even though he almost has a little, maybe slightly less to do, I like the character of Dr. Verringer in this film, because he's weaselly and strange and creepy.
You know, he's also an Illinois Nazi, but...
And there's these little approaches to it that I like in the Altman movie. But it's, as I said at the beginning, it's done in a way where it's probably the most faithful, non-faithful adaptation of a book I've ever watched, because it really does take... It's not just a mood piece in the sense you're talking about. And, you know, you're right. I think you would, if you did it in the modern day, you would have a level of a mood piece to it, and people would make it a little bit more, like, you know, pretentious and try and tap into things. But I think, or they'd make it very contemporary and try and make a comment on today. And that's quite what people do all the time now with everything. But Altman did that without, I think it's such a mood piece because it's rooted in the psychology of that era, even more than, you know, these days, when people are trying to make a point about the modern day, it's so crowbarred in, it's so obvious.
It can feel transparent.
It can feel transparent because they've come at something, they've gone, okay, we want to make a comment about Trumpism, we want to make a comment about Brexitism, we want to make a comment, you know, etc. Whereas this, it's not making a comment about the fact that America's going to hell in a handcart. America just is going to hell in a handcart, and they happen to be filming it at the same time. And having these feelings and these moods and having, you know, this approach, I really don't think for a minute it never feels transparent. It feels very true to the psychology of the era, if you see what I mean. And that's one of the reasons it was so enjoyable, and why when it does deviate from the book, it's enjoyable in itself, because I really don't think you could ever have made this film the way it was made then in any other time. I think it is very much of its time, while still, like, you know, looking ahead at the naturalism, some of the naturalism that you will get later from certain filmmakers, and having, you know, I mean, it's really interesting that at first the producers offered Howard Hawks the chance to direct this towards the end of his life. Obviously, Howard Hawks directed The Big Sleep. So imagine what you would have got potentially if Howard Hawks had done this. You know, you might have got The Big Sleep too, in many ways, you know, in terms of, he may well have made this that very concise, very plot driven adaptation that is faithful to the book. And I think at this stage, you would never have got as interesting an adaptation at this point in time if that's what they would have done.
I mean, it's just, what was so interesting about the new wave in general was there was a look back into the 50s and going, well, this is what we like, this is what we watch, this is what we're entertained by, let's kind of bring it up to the forefront and change it and warp it and muck around with everything. And it's important to realise that for all this hand-wringing that we're seeing over films like Star Wars, you know, one of the things that George Lucas was doing was looking at old dogfights from the 40s and 50s movies, and looking at all those things from like his childhood and revamping them and changing them and putting them into something new and everything else like that. And I think you have something like this where you just have someone who's going, well, I'm going to go really off piece, and I think people may not like this, but I don't care enough. Yeah. Yeah. I just don't. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I love about when I watch Altman is it's just so easy to watch. There's this kind of lyricism that goes into it, and watching this again, I think this is the fourth time I've seen this film, it was so easy to just slip into this movie. Like I didn't find that when I look back at some of the other hard-boiled noirs. The way everything's set up is it's so early in cinema that it's really hard to go back and look at some of the older films, not because they're bad, but because Citizen Kane really changed everything.
Yeah.
like so much. Like Citizen Kane, obviously the year of 1939, when there's a whole bunch of, like, when movies really turned around and went, look, we're going to do this now and change it. So looking at some of these noirs and the high-waisted pants and the quick talking, it wasn't as if they were bad. It was just that we've seen it so much. And we've seen it kind of parodied and made fun of on Family Guy and everything else like that. So when you see something, so when I saw something like this again, it's just like, I think he made something not foolproof, because I'm sure there's someone who will dislike it and find the self-mocking tone to be quite annoying. But he just makes something his own in the way that only he can. And he makes something that is so just not just beautiful to look at, but so interestingly of the time and what he seemed to be saying at the time, even if he used unconscious or not, he was saying that this is a tragic time. And to look back at the book and the films of the 50s as well, they were also turning around and saying, well, we've just come off a war. This is where we are at this moment in time, and this is what people are doing. There is still an element of desperation and seediness. And I think he just revamped it, updated it, and made it into the 70s. And I think that's quite cool. I think it's just a really interesting way of how he took it and just looked at everything in a slightly askew, different way.
It's less fatalistic than the book. You know, Chandler is... He's very fatalistic, and he's right. I think of it as like a beautiful fatalism, because his prose is wonderful. It's stunning. It's so evocative, and it's brutal, but it's also, you know, elegiac. There's something really entrancing about the way he writes, even though it really does knock you for six at times. But he is fatalistic. You know, ultimately, Marlowe is very much the kind of guy who, you know, he won't get attached to anyone. He's quite a nihilist in his, you know, in a far ahead of a postmodern way. You know, it's not the nihilism of Fight Club. It's just a very nihilistic sort of, you know, approach to life. But in The Long Goodbye in the film, it's a little bit like Marlowe is, yeah, there's much more of a in the book, there's much more of a sharpness to that. There's much more of a sharpness to that fatalism in the film, and a lot of it maybe comes down to Elliot Gould's performance. You know, in the way he just glides around the movie and sort of lets the movie envelop around him. I would say it's like all the characters around him are grotesques, or they're, you know, violent, or they're sexual, and he sort of just glides through it in this old, almost old-fashioned suit, you know, that he's always wearing, with his cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and this very hangdog sort of, you know, figure. But he's got almost a playfulness to him as well. He has a certain, you know, he skips through the odd moment, and he's got a dry wit. You know, he will face the, you know, heavies, or he'll face these brutal cops with a quip, with a line. You know, in much more of a way than than Marlowe does in the book. That kind of wit is a little bit more modern. You know, it's a little bit more of a darker tone in a way. Whereas here, he's a lot more like, hey, Chum, you know, there's a playfulness about it, which I like, because it's such a contrast at the end when he does that, when he shoots that gun, and it that's why that comes as such of a shock to me.
To be kind of to take this into a different route for me, it's interesting you bring up the in the book he seems more nihilistic, because you get the feeling here in this alliteration of the guy, especially with his saying "it's okay with me," there's an almost absurdist view towards everything, where it doesn't matter either way. Opposed to, instead of nihilistic and fatalistic, where it's like, I don't believe in anything, there's a sort of absurdist like, well, either way I don't mind. You know, the cat doesn't want to eat the food. Well, I don't care. Girls, you want the cookie? Here's this, and he just walks off, and everything else like that. There is just this absurdist view that comes through, and that's something that you kind of see in Altman movies anyway. I mean, it's one of the things that people found quite awkward about Anderson's Magnolia is it just seems to be about chance and just things happening, and then but he takes his riff off Shortcuts, which ends with all these characters milling around everywhere, just kind of living their lives, and these really kind of intimate small dramas, and then boom, there's a massive earthquake. So it's not raining frogs like in Magnolia, it's just an earthquake that kind of brings people together, tears people apart, and it's just a thing that happens. And there's just an absurdist nature to it. And it's the same with, what's the other thing? There's an absurdist nature to the player, which kind of circles in on itself and becomes a screenplay, even though you were watching something before. There's the same kind of view that you see in, and I'm trying, Three Women, where the women that you're watching kind of turn into each other and kind of absorb everything, and like in Bergman's Persona. And it's just, and at the end of that film, you don't really know what happened to those people, and yet they've just allowed themselves to be. They just allowed this stuff to happen. It's just a part of something that's occurring, and they're allowing this stuff to happen. And I think it's the same here. And I find that really interesting to have with the Gumshoe and to have with a detective, to be like, he still has that itch he can scratch, but he is a Mr. C of toxicity, and he just goes, well, I'm swimming against the tide here, I may as well let it just take me away.
Yeah, I can't do anything about it. Exactly, it's that I can try and find some level of justice, you know, because in the book it's all about finding justice, it's all about trying to, you know, see through either the corruption or, you know, the wealthy elites who are trying to control everything, and, you know, the idea that, you know, there is just this absolute, you know, rot at the heart of American high society. And here, you know, in the 50s, I think it was the fear of that rot. You know, by the 70s, that rot is there. That rot is, it's seen, it's obvious. Nobody's even trying to hide it anymore. You know, there's loose morals everywhere. You know, those girls in his apartment with their boobs out, you know, smoking weed, nobody cares anymore. You know, they've got to the point now where everybody just, you know, the world is just open in that sense, and he's amidst it in a city like LA, you know, where corruption is everywhere, and but he's passive about it. He wants to find out the truth. He wants to, you know, like I say, he wants to believe that Terry Lennox didn't kill his wife, but equally at the same time, he feels passive about all these grotesques around him, all these people, because he knows that this is what the world is now. There's no changing it. He can't change anything. He can't make it better. He's got to find whatever he can in it. And I think that's quite a powerful thing to watch. And I think that's why Altman films it in this certain way. You know, he has that haze. You know, he says that he was inspired by, like, old postcards from the 40s, you know, in order to give it that pastel look. And that's... So he wants to almost capture that look of the age where Marlowe would have been much more of a, maybe a, you know, if fatalistic, but a determined sort of righteous detective, you know, who will follow all these plot points to get to it. Whereas now Marlowe's living in a world where he sort of just ends up in the middle of stuff. And I like that in a way. I like that level of passivity. I mean, it's really sort of writ large in that scene with the character of Marty Augustine, who's the mob guy, when they're in his home, cameo by Arnie, by the way, which I went, that's Arnie. I was like, is that Arnie with a moustache? Yeah, really weird. But in that scene where, you know, he's going, take your clothes off, and they're going to kill him. You know, they're basically, but Marlowe is approaching it. He's not scared. He's just sort of there with his cigarette out, going, do I have to? You know, and then he's saved in the 11th hour, just by sheer dumb luck, where the money comes back to Marty, and they let him go. And this is, I love that, because in any other film it would be this really sort of tense scene, but it is absurdist. You know, he's taking off all his clothes, he's going, take your clothes off, you guys, take your clothes off, and he's like, oh Marty, we gotta take our clothes off, take them off, get your clothes off. And you know, I was there laughing, thinking, shouldn't this be a scene in any other film? This would be a scene where Marlowe is, you know, getting cut up and there's a lot of aggression and things like that. In this, it's absurd LA, you know, I don't even know how to explain it. It is that absurdity, and I really like that. I really like that approach about it, and I think it's unique to Altman in that sense, certainly at this point.
But there's still a lot of danger in the movie. I mean, that same character earlier on takes his girlfriend, drinks a bottle of Coke, and just smashes the bottle against it.
That's vicious.
And it's such a vicious moment. So out of left field. Mm. And it's not necessarily out of left field. It's, you just realise that, I don't know, like, if you were, a lot of the time I think when you watch certain films, you'd expect that the hero would get the beating, get the punching and everything else like that, and get the, you know, when you watch Chinatown, it's Jake Gittes gets his nose cut. Mm. Whereas here, it's like, I'm just going to show you something and go, and it's like, look, I love her and I don't even like you. What will happen to you is way worse. Yeah. And there is that element of fear and paranoia that gets placed in there. And I think that's, it's just an interesting way to go with the movie. I think it's like a fascinating way to go with the movie, when you could have easily just made it more explicitly towards Marlowe, but it also, and in this day and age, if we watch something like that, we may be a bit aware it might be just fridging a female character, because there's not that many female characters, and they're not particularly the nicest in here. But I think it's I just think it's a fascinating way to just show the danger and how fearful you should be in this new LA, so to speak.
Yeah, and that it's that contrast between that underbelly of horrible violence and that absurdism of the, you know, the social elite and things like that. And I think that's one of the things that makes it for me. It's just a really, really interesting adaptation. I would encourage anyone to look it up. I would encourage anyone as well to, if you can, read the book first, actually, because then you will really come at this and you will see a lot of the differences. And there are lots of differences, you know. There are characters who aren't there. There are major plot points changed. And you'll see a very different tone to the book than the film, as we've discussed, you know. And, you know, it was interesting because Chandler said that he thought that was his best book, that he thought that was his best novel, The Long Sleep and The Big Goodbye. and this is it, I think. The Long Goodbye isn't necessarily considered Altman's greatest work, but I think it's perhaps been a little bit lost and maybe forgotten over the years. So it would be nice to see it, you know, in some respects rediscovered.
Well, I think it did get, I think it got discovered quite well, in the sense of we're here talking about it now, and we've got, it came out on, it was a really delightful Blu-ray edition, if you can find it in, and it's, who is it? It's Arrow that brought out.
Oh, yeah, Arrow was.
That brought it out, and it's really worthwhile to watch. And obviously, when you watch it in the pastel like colours that come through, there's this really lovely moment where there's a guy on the piano trying to get the song right, and the song is, of course, The Long Goodbye. But then also Marlowe's just there waiting with a drink. And it's this lovely dark, lovely dark shot. That just happens, and nothing's really occurring in it, but it's just really well balanced and leveled and beautiful to look at. I don't think, as much as I love the look of the film, there isn't a shot that reminds me of the, I think it's the moment of The Big Sleep, where you've got Bogart kind of sitting down as someone, as a character has just drank some poison, knowing that he's going to die, and he's just sitting there, head down, and the hat's just draped over, and the dead body's just by in front of him, and there's nothing as kind of as that hits home as much as that. Maybe the moment of violence, I guess. But there are some really arresting scenes in here, watching Aline drive off, and he's chasing after her, and she can clearly see him, and she's just smiling and thinking she's getting away with it, and all that, and that aspect of it. The end of the film, which is a riff on The Third Man, when he walks past her and pulls out the harmonica and starts dancing and whatnot. But also the actual suicide of Wade's character is such a hard to watch moment. Mm-hmm. If only for the fact that there's no music, there's nothing to it. It's just someone who's just walked into the sea and is just a lost, and that's it. You're not that, you know, there's no more there, and he had demons and God knows what happened. So it has got this moment, and it's just a really, really powerful, for me it's a really, really powerful mood piece and a really powerful dream like film from a maverick of American cinema.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, it's one I will definitely revisit, absolutely. Well, yeah, it's been really good to talk about The Big Goodbye. So before you go, Les, tell everyone about where they can find more of A, you talking, and B, you writing, because you do a fair bit of both.
I'm writing for Set the Tape. I've kind of stopped writing more long form pieces on my blog. I kind of fallen out of love with modern movies, but I think a lot of the discourse has become quite boring, and I find myself getting more frustrated. But you can find some of my older pieces on afrofilmviewer.com, or just, you know, type in afrofilmviewer. Your best bet was just to find me on Twitter, and I'm there via afrofilmviewer, and I try and put everything out there. If you want to hear me talk even more, I am part of a podcast called Fatal Attractions, which is on Twitter as Fatal Attract Pod, and we do a kind of bi-weekly, kind of tri-weekly podcast on erotic thrillers and of the 80s and 90s and what we love about them and hate about them. And then also you can find me on Bunkerzilla, and I am on sometimes SoundCloud under Hustlers of Culture with me and my friend Hugh David, where we talk about pop culture we have a discourse from two people from very different backgrounds to the Western world, so to speak. So yeah, there's many ways to find me.
all good ways, and I'd urge anyone to go and check out Les's writing, especially, you know, his podcasting's fantastic. His writing's, you know, really great.
So do go and look that up at all the places he said.
Okay, that's all for today, listeners. I'll be back with a new Noirvember episode next week, all being well, so I hope you can join me for that. But I'll leave you for now with a quick look at some of the other shows you can hear on the We Made This network.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Observing the Pattern, a Fringe podcast.
You know, you'd have a doctor saying, oh, well, it's because, you know, if someone's come back from dead, it's because they were frozen and their body temperature warmed up, or, you know, oh, they ingested this poison that, you know, made it look like death, or whatever it was, rather than it being a miracle that's seen as the more outlandish thing. So it's quite interesting seeing the roles reversed here.
Because
I know our sympathies lie with Walter, but then equally, I felt kind of sorry for the priest who's just like, right, you realise this is mad, right?
Yeah.
There's no part of this that is safe.
Life's Milestones.
That Stephen King thing with the evil cat people. For goodness sake. How old were you?
The time is now. A Millennium podcast.
Yeah, I think when we get to Skull and Bones, the final scene in that one, where he gives his reasons to Emma, I think that has been criticised quite much. But then, obviously, we'll look at Peter Watts over the course of the season.
That's perfect. That's perfect. Yeah. Because I mean, how many times, you know, that's what people in his position say.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you hate me and you think I'm doing bad, but you know, when the food runs out, you know, who are you going to blame? That goes back to 3 days of the Condor, right?
Yeah.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.